6,000 feet, where this blowing wind and the very thin air made his survival very doubtful, carrying somebody off the mountain who had magically or amazingly appeared when he had been given up for dead. And there was another side as well. There were Japanese climbers who were making their way, and they were radioed that there was three Indian climbers who were on a ledge, and they were within their vicinity. And their choice was theirs, to break off the climb which they'd invested in, or to go and rescue these people, or to go for the summit. And climbers have a code. That was why it was astonishing when a couple of hours later the summit had a radio voice coming back that these climbers, these Japanese climbers, had gone for the top. They claimed that they hadn't really made a choice. The Indian climbers could have made it on their own. But the fact is they froze to death on that ledge, because here were people who were living out their own agenda. There's something about lost people and lost situations which either brings out the best in us or the worst in us. A week ago, Saturday night, a group of us were sitting out in our backyard, and all of a sudden a helicopter began to fly over. Hadn't heard one do this before. All of a sudden the announcement came over that this was the San Bernardino Sheriff's helicopter, and there was an 80-year-old woman, and they gave her name, who was lost. And had anybody found her? Had anybody seen her? And I looked around. She wasn't in our group, and and it's one of those moments you don't know quite what to do. And we thought, I thought a lot about that woman this week. I wonder what her story was. I wonder about an 80-year-old woman who they're sending helicopters to look for. Was she confused? Did she have Alzheimer's disease and wander away? Did she had she been abducted? Had something? I wonder whether they ever found her. I never heard the other side of the story, but I have thought about that. And I was grateful to live in a place that sends out helicopters to look for 80-year-old people who were lost. But I couldn't help but think how different my reaction would have been if it had been my little girl or a family member or a close friend whose name had been announced over that helicopter, and how different my response would have been if it had been one of my loved ones who was lost. The Lord Jesus lived his life with a tenacious sense of purpose. He had a kind of a laser beam focus on a mission. He knew who he was. He knew why he had come. From the very first time he ever spoke in a synagogue, when he announced that the Spirit of God was upon him and he had sent him to proclaim liberty to captives and to give sight to the blind and set free those who were bound, he lived his life. Well, he later said that his purpose was to seek and to save that which was lost. The culmination of that was Jerusalem. Back in Luke chapter 9, verse 51, knowing that that was the focus, we're told that he set his face. The Old Testament says he set his face like a flint. That is, like a rock-like determination that nothing was going to deter, nothing was going to deflect. He moves inexorably toward Jerusalem, because that, above everywhere else, is going to be the place where he seeks and saves that which is lost. By laying down his life, by pouring himself out as a sacrifice. But along the way, as he makes his way to Jerusalem, he keeps gathering in people and he keeps calling his disciples to understand, this is who I am. This is what I'm about. This is my mission. This is my purpose. Man, I don't ever want you to forget, I came to seek and to save that which was lost. And if you follow me, you not only follow my salvation and find my life, you need to enter my purpose. My people follow me, and they follow me into a mission of seeking and saving that which was lost, because people matter to the Lord, and lost people matter to the Lord. And because they matter to Him, they must matter to us. I want you to look with me at a passage this morning that is taking us to the end of this journey we've been walking with Jesus. And Jerusalem is going to get to be in sight when we get to Luke chapter 18. Next week, we're going to have the last episode before Jesus enters Jerusalem. And we're going to set aside the book of Luke for a time and enter into a marvelous passage this summer. If I can give you some advance anticipation of that, we're going to spend our summer looking at life-changing truths and life-changing relationships. And I'm going to be focusing our attention for 6 weeks on one of the great chapters in all of God's Word. And if it sinks into your heart, some wonderful things will sink into your heart. Romans chapter 8 is going to be our focus this summer. And then Rick is going to take us and think through, in the middle of that time, some life-changing relationships with our relationship to God and others and to ourselves. And we're going to have a great time thinking through some life-changing things this summer. But this journey with Jesus is life-changing. And in Luke chapter 18 and verse 31, Jesus is preparing now for this last climb. They're nearing the city of Jericho. Jericho's 17 miles, an uphill walk to Jerusalem. We have the story of the Good Samaritan, the man who was attacked coming down from Jerusalem to Jericho. Now Jesus, the Good Samaritan, is making his way up to Jerusalem to lay down his life. And he wants his disciples to know exactly what's ahead. So you'll notice in verse 31 of Luke 18, he says, Jesus took the 12 aside and told them, "We're going up to Jerusalem, and everything that is written by the prophets about the Son of Man," and that was his title for himself, "will be fulfilled. He will be handed over to the Gentiles. They will mock him, insult him, spit on him, flog him, and kill him. On the third day, he will rise again." Disciples didn't understand any of this. Its meaning was hidden from them, and they didn't know what he was talking about. As Jesus approached Jericho, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. Mark gives his name as Bartimaeus. Luke allows him to be anonymous. When he heard the crowd going by, he asked what was happening. They told him, "Jesus of Nazareth is passing by." He called out, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." Those who led the way rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and ordered the man to be brought to him. When he came near, Jesus asked him, "What do you want me to do for you?" "Lord, I want to see." Jesus said to him, "Receive your sight. Your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus, praising God. When all the people saw it, they also praised God. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but being a short man, he could not because of the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed them gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, "He's gone to be the guest of a sinner." But Jesus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half my possessions to the poor, and if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost." I went to university at the University of British Columbia, which is in Vancouver, and it's situated on Point Grey, which is a beautiful little point that moves out into the ocean. And so the school is surrounded on two sides by ocean and one side by river. And in the wintertime, the fog would roll in into that particular spot. And one of my great memories of sitting in the classroom was hearing the foghorn going, and it just went like that incessantly, over and over. And so I have a foghorn as a memory of the University of British Columbia, and I think of that sound. Now, if you're caught out in the fog, and I've been in a boat caught out in the fog, foghorn is tremendously valuable, and it's tremendously useful. The striking thing about a foghorn, though, is that it's doing its job most effectively when everybody's staying away. Because that's what it's all about. Stay away from here. This is a bad news place. However, unless you've got charts, knowing where you should stay away from doesn't get you home. If you want to get home, if you're lost, you need more than "don't come here." And normally, if you're really in desperate states, you need somebody who's going to come and do a search and rescue and is going to find you when you're lost out there. The Church of Jesus Christ has not been called to be a foghorn.
And sometimes that's what it sounds like to the world. Spends its time giving bad news to people. It's been called to be a search and rescue operation that enters the lostness of people's lives and brings them home, brings them to a safe place. That's what heaven is all about. But that's also what the Lord Jesus is modeling. And in chapter 19, verse 10, he makes a statement which virtually all commentators are agreed is not only one of the great verses of the Bible, it's the great statement of the Lord's life. It's one of those mottos. It's what Luke is all about. If you're choosing a theme verse for the book of Luke, you don't need to look any further than this. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost. And as it were, Jesus boils his whole life down into that manifesto. He gives it in a number of different ways through his life. But that's who he is. God sent his Son, not to condemn the world, but that the world through Jesus might be saved. Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which is lost. It's a reminder to us that people are lost. That because of who we are and what we've done, we're separated from God and we're in darkness and we're not going to find our way home on our own. We're lost. Now, one of the truths about lost people is that they have all kinds of different reactions. Some don't know they're lost. I mean, if you've ever had a child in a department store that's run off, and all of a sudden you get frantic because your child isn't where they're supposed to be, and your mind begins to run wild with all kinds of things, and then you discover them playing. They don't know they're lost. They don't know what you've gone through, and all kinds of people in the world don't know they're lost. Other people won't admit they're lost. I'm told, unfairly, I'm sure, by people responsible, that men have a certain tendency to not like to admit they're lost when they're driving a car. That there's some very rare occasions when we've been known to be reluctant to ask for directions or to get help. But there is a tendency not to want to admit we're lost. I can find my own way here. And as we pass the same location for the fourth time, we begin to think maybe now it is appropriate. There are people who don't mind being lost. Quite frankly, they're having a good time doing what they're doing. But there's that awful moment sometimes that settles deeply in and you realize not only am I lost, but I am dangerously lost. And I need to get out of this particular situation. And so when Jesus announces he'd come to seek and to save that which is lost, he is announcing his mission in the light of the needs of people that you and I, apart from a relationship with God that can only be established by Jesus Christ, because if there's any way he would have not launched a mission that costs so much, that we're lost. But we matter. Rick's already reminded us that there are some things that we can do without, but there are some things that when we're lost, we just sort of go our way. Well, I'm lost, that's kind of a nuisance, but I can replace it. Or I can get along without it. But there are other things that when they're lost, most significantly, there are people who when they're lost, our whole set of priorities change. We not only search, we search frantically. Everything becomes adjusted to the fact that my little child is lost. My 80-year-old mother is lost, and I will call any resource into bear because that matters to me. With everything that I own, nothing is too great a price to pay. I want what's lost to be found. And the God of heaven views people like that. He views us like that. That you matter to God with a love that matters, that causes him to say, I'll pay the price. That my own son will come on a search and rescue operation. And Jesus will announce, I'm come to seek and to save that which is lost. I want you to notice in this passage that Jesus is telling us, both by his model and by his teaching, what it means to love the lost. Not only so that we'll understand he loves us like that, but he'll call us to understand how we enter into his mission of loving the lost. And loving the lost means paying the price. That's why in verse 31, having announced at the end of the section that love searches for what it values, in verses 31 to 34, he reminds us, as the table reminds us, that love pays whatever the search and rescue costs. So he calls aside the 12. They're going to be the ones that are going to be the leaders of the church, although one of them is going to betray him.
One of them is going to listen to what is said, and he's going to become the source of much of what takes place,
because Judas is one of those who hears. They've heard Jesus say this plainly twice before, at least twice before, but now he says it again so they can have no doubt, and so it can be absolutely clear in their mind. And yet it's so unbelievable to them. It so breaks apart their understanding and their conceptions that they don't get it. And verse 34 will end up saying they didn't understand anything of what he was talking about. Because they'd seen Jesus perform miracles. They'd seen Jesus, as they will in just a moment, give sight to blind eyes. How could he, who could still the waves at the sound of his voice, who could cast out demons by simply speaking, who could silence his enemies by the sheer wisdom of his words, how could he have this happen to him?
But Jesus says it clearly. Everything written by the prophets about the Son of Man will be fulfilled.
And then he focuses on two ideas that are especially significant for this one time. There will be betrayal. He will be handed over to the Gentiles. A Jew is going to hand him over to the Romans. You remember the wave of horror that went through Israel just when Yitzhak Rabin was killed, and there was a sense, if an Arab had done that, we would have understood, but a Jew doing that to another Jew? And there was a deep sense of betrayal. And that's the sense here. He's going to be handed over. Jews are going to betray him to Gentiles. And there was this kind of solidarity that exists. It exists not just in the Jewish people, but in all kinds of others. That's not the way you treat one of your kind. You may oppose them, but you don't give them over. And Judas is going to be responsible for betraying him to the Jewish leaders. And the Jewish leaders are going to wash their hands of him and turn him over to the Romans.
And then Jesus talks about the brutality he's going to know. Be handed over to the Gentiles. They will mock him. They will insult him. And the word is a very strong word. They're going to shame him, abuse him, mistreat him. They will spit on him. They will flog him.
And he uses a word that describes the whip that had tied into the leather a piece of bone or a piece of metal or a piece of glass. So the optimum ripping open of your back flesh would take place as you were beaten with it.
And then Jesus says they're going to kill him.
He'd earlier talked about crucifixion. And on the third day, he'll rise again.
Now, why is the Lord going through this?
I think he wants his disciples, because he knows they're not going to understand, but he wants them to understand that he knew exactly what lay ahead. He knew precisely what was going to take place. This search and rescue operation, the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost, was not going to be a helicopter flight swooping in and then flying off in glory and splendor. It was going to be a bloody execution, a brutal betrayal. Disciples didn't understand any of it. I mean, they didn't expect either the brutality, the betrayal, the crucifixion, or the resurrection.
And there's something very profound in that. That the accounts of what happened to the Lord were not the inventions of people who had it all worked out ahead of time.
They openly say, we didn't expect it. We didn't understand it. It didn't make sense to us. But Jesus knew exactly what lay ahead, and he was willing to pay the price. He knew exactly what it would cost. No one takes my life from me. I lay it down on my own initiative, he says in John chapter 10. And if I lay it down on my own initiative, I'll take it again.
And the Lord Jesus is reminding us that love pays whatever search and rescue costs, because that which is love matters to him. And the challenge for those of us who are Christ followers is, how much do we love what Jesus loves?
I mean, we delight in the fact that he loves us like this. But what about the rest of those for whom he laid down his life? Do we value that which is lost? And are we willing to pay the price? Are we willing to make their rescue our priority? Because the greatest danger of the followers of Christ down through the ages is they've asked the church to be organized around their convenience rather than around their mission. They've asked the church to be organized around how their needs can be cared for rather than how the lost's needs can be cared for. But loving the lost means willing to be involved in a search and rescue mission that will pay the price. Well, the Lord gathers up his men and they begin to walk their way through Jericho, and they're going to make their way through Jericho up to Jerusalem. But in the providence of God, there are two divine appointments that are meant to live out that Jesus is going not only to seek and to save that which is lost in Jerusalem. And you know, if you think about this, it would be very easy for Jesus to be distracted at this point because Jerusalem's getting closer. I don't know whether you've ever had something that you knew was going to demand everything out of you, and as the closer it gets, you just get distracted. And it's very hard to think of others in other situations because this is in front of you and it's consuming all of your energy. Jesus could easily have been excused for being distracted as he thinks about the betrayal and brutality and crucifixion and all that lies ahead. But along the way, as they come into the city of Jericho, they meet two men, Matthew tells us. But one of them is focused on by Luke and by Mark. And he's apparently the spokesman for the group. We're not told, as I've mentioned here in Luke, but we are told in Mark that his name is Bartimaeus. And as Bartimaeus is sitting there, he's a blind man. And he's a beggar. Now that calls out our sympathy. But I need to tell you, if you've traveled in places where there are beggars, beggars become part of the scenery. Because there's all kinds of needs, especially in the kind of medical circumstances they had in that society. And they become a source of annoyance. I remember a trip to Israel, and especially going into Hebron, the one time we could go there, and there were beggars there. But these were not just beggars, these were aggressive. And they would come up, and they would virtually attack you in their aggressiveness. And there was blind people there, and there was all kinds of people in that particular situation. I mean, we understand how it feels to meet homeless people. And there are times where it calls out our sympathy and concern, but there's other times where we just think, no! And we see that and we recoil against that. Maybe it's familiarity, maybe it's a kind of contempt, whatever else we see that, and we don't see this as an opportunity to minister, and we don't see a lost person, we see a nuisance to be dealt with. It's what the crowd saw. The noise gathers. There's people gathering around Jesus. He's known for his miracle power. And there's a kind of a hubbub. And Bartimaeus, who of course cannot see, hears the hubbub. And he asks, what's going on? And he says, Jesus of Nazareth is coming by. And there's this kind of flurry of expectation and this buzz that is gathering around the people. And that name rings a bell with Bartimaeus. I have no idea what he knew about him. I have no idea what he understood about him, except he uses one of the great titles in the Jewish understanding of things. The Son of David meant the Messiah, the one whom God has sent. And I don't know why he used that title at the initial stage. Maybe he had come to some kind of understanding of who Jesus was. But he begins to cry out, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And he's not asking for money. He's asking for Jesus' power, and the people around said, shut up. Be quiet. Just going to annoy him. Just stand out of the way. Don't you ever know when it's time? Just he's not into, he can't, not going to be bothered with you. And it says they sternly rebuked him. Quit being a nuisance. And it says he cried out the more, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. I think there's more here than just a story because there's almost a kind of parable. There's all kinds of hurting people in our world and quite frankly, they can become a kind of nuisance to us. I mean, they're still blind, they still have needs, they still need to beg, but we just get tired of being faced by those things and it's just sit still and be quiet. Because we live in a world in which we're bombarded by the needs of people. The striking thing is that Jesus chose to hear the cry of a blind beggar. He could have been excused, as I've said, for being distracted. He could have said, you know, not now. I've got other things on my mind, big things on my mind. But in a world in which people are telling him, be quiet, Bartimaeus, the blind man, is heard by Jesus. And Jesus reaches out to him, and he calls him to himself. I think it's fascinating to see what Jesus does. When he came near, Jesus asked him, what do you want me to do for you? Ever notice the interesting questions people asked? You're carrying around your arm in a sling, and somebody says, oh, did you hurt your arm? No. You're all dressed up, and somebody says, oh, where have you been? I've been at Frank and Joe's wedding. Oh, did Frank and Joe get married? What do you want me to do for you? It seems like one of those questions. I mean, it should be obvious. I meant to say Frank and Joan, actually, by the way, here. Suddenly occurred to me that that was not a slip of tongue that I should make at this stage. Can we go on now? What was I saying? What do you want me to do for you? There's another time. Jesus comes to a man who's lying paralyzed beside a pool. Do you want to be made well? Been there for 46 years. Do you want to be made well? The fact is, not everybody does. I mean, there's some people who have an illness or a need, and quite frankly, they've come to embrace the identity that that need gives them. They've come to enjoy, in a kind of perverse way, the attention that that illness brings. And they sort of enjoy the irresponsibility that comes from being blind. I mean, I've never had to hold a job. I get my sight back, I'm going to have to work for a living. I'm not going to have other people caring for me. I think, too, that Jesus is calling out to see just exactly how much do you know of me and how much do you trust me. There's a famous old story of a preacher who was talking to his younger brother about this story and said, if you'd been Bartimaeus, what would you have asked for? And the little boy said, I would have asked for a seeing eye dog. And you think, what are you going to ask for from Jesus when he comes and says what your need is? Just to make life a little easier within the confines of that? Or are you going to really trust him? And so Jesus asks, how much do you trust me? What do you want? What do you want me to do for you? And how would you answer that, Jesus? What do you want me to do for you? Lord, I'd just like you to make my home a little more peaceful. I'd like you to meet this particular need. I'd like you to do that for me. And this man looks at him and says, Lord, I want to see. I want my sight back. And I know you can do that. I believe that you can make the blind see. I want to see. And Jesus looks at him and says, receive your sight. Your faith has saved you. New International Version translates it, your faith has healed you, but elsewhere, that word is the word that's normally used for salvation. Your word has, your faith has saved you. You've not only received sight for your eyes, that you've received the salvation of God. What do you want me to do for you? What will you do with it when you get it? And all of a sudden, this man sees. What would you do if for the first time in your life, you had new sight and you could see? I love what this man did. He used his new sight and he used his new life to follow Jesus and to glorify him. Because it says, immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus, praising God. When the people saw it, they also praised God. Jesus chose to hear the cry of a hurting, needy man and not to pass him by. And loving the lost means hearing the cry of needy people and not telling them to be quiet and not pushing them out of the way, but in the name of Jesus, going to them and offering them not simply sight for their eyes, but life for their heart. And that's our mission, to go into a world of people who are lost and bring them light.
Well, they continue on through the city, and as this caravan passes through, the word spreads that Jesus of Nazareth is here, and it reaches an interesting man. He's the chief tax collector of the area, and that term has all kinds of significance for people. It means he was a thoroughly disreputable man. He'd won the contract from the Romans to gather a certain number of dollars out of that particular area. They farmed out the tax contracts. Zacchaeus had won it for the area of Jericho because it was right near the Jordan River. There was all kinds of traffic coming across the Jordan. Most of the taxes were tolls and customs duties. And he had a group of men working for him, and they were thoroughly hated individuals because they were working the Roman side of the street, and they were also working under the counter in terms of taking money and exploiting people and abusing people. We've seen tax collectors all the way through, and the consistent note is they were hated by the people, and it will be the note in this particular passage. Because when Jesus has anything to do with this person, people will say, how can he be a good man and deal with Zacchaeus? Zacchaeus was a disreputable man who was also a very wealthy man. We're told that. He was rich. But there was a hole in his heart. It was a kind of strange thing. It's not said he was a short man who wanted to see Jesus. I have no idea why he wanted to see Jesus. Except there was something about him that was drawn. You wouldn't have expected it. You wouldn't have expected a man like this to have any interest in spiritual things. You would have written him off the list as the most likely candidate in Jericho. I mean, a man who lives with that kind of moral life, a man who lives with that kind of ethical life, a man who has that kind of spiritual and religious value, so he's a traitor to his nation and isn't allowed in the synagogue to worship God under any normal situation, you would have said, that's a man who's got life together in his own terms. He won't want Jesus of Nazareth. But he does. And yet there's something about him that, well, he does something very strange. I mean, how many bank managers do you know who will climb trees to watch a parade go by? That's not something a well-placed businessman who's dealing with the Romans does. You don't climb trees. You don't sit as a CEO of a major tax firm up a tree hoping that things will pass by. And you want to see, and yet you don't want to come out in the open. I think Zacchaeus is like a lot of people in our world. I mean, they've got a lot of things together, and in some ways they are the envy of many people. They've made their money. They've got their position. They have their place of power. They are feared, if not loved. And yet there's a hunger in their heart that they're not willing to share even with other people. There was an interesting article in the LA Times this week that was entitled Build It Yourself Religion. And it talked about our generation, the Quest generation, as the Xers and Boomers are being talked about today. And William Clark Roof, who's written a book called Generation of Seekers and is a sociologist up at the University of California at Santa Barbara, writes this in the article, many people are turning inward in a genuine quest for spiritual meaning. They're experiencing a profound spiritual struggle to make sense of all that's going on in the world. They're going off in all directions. I see a lot of do-it-yourself spirituality. And there's Zacchaeus. He's on a spiritual quest. There's a hunger in his heart, and there's a hunger in the hearts of all kinds of people around us today. And they're turning in so many different directions. Many of them are not even considering the gospel of Jesus Christ an option because either on one side of bad childhood experiences or an image they see in the media, or they enter into a church context and there's such a stained glass barrier between what they hear and the world in which they live. There's no answers there, and the tragedy is all kinds of them, and I think there's a symbolism that I don't think's in the text, but all kinds of questers, I think, end up stuck up a tree because they're lurking in the most absurd way places. And Jesus comes along. And here's a man with a quest in his heart, but that quest would have gone unsatisfied if Jesus hadn't taken the initiative and gone and stood and looked up in that tree. And think of this at this moment. If Jesus had been different than he was, think of what he could have done to Zacchaeus. I mean, he could have embarrassed him.
He could have shamed him. He would have got the cheers of the crowd. Everybody else in Jericho would have said, "Did you hear what Jesus did to that blankety-blank Zacchaeus? Stuck up a tree, and he pointed him out." It was so good to have a belly laugh at that man's expense. But Jesus doesn't see a sinful man who ought to be ridiculed. He sees a hurting man who needs to be searched and rescued. And he doesn't embarrass him. He honors him. "I'm going to come home with you. I'm going to eat with you." I stumbled into that statement before about marriage. And yet in a time when we're taking a moral stand and rightly against issues like homosexual marriage, how many people who are up a tree out of that moral dilemma have only heard Christians throw rotten apples at them rather than enter into a relationship to them so they can meet the Son of God? There's all kinds of issues where I think we sound like a foghorn to our society, where we're blaring bad news and we're causing people who are hurt and lost to stay away rather than standing there and saying, "Zacchaeus, I'm going to eat with you. We're going to share a meal together." And the crowd say, "You can't do that." And we aren't given any of the details. All we know is, and I think the way the text tells it, it happens right away. Zacchaeus looks into the eyes of Jesus as the Lord looks up at him, and he gets down out of that tree, and in the moment he met the eyes of Jesus, one on one, his heart was transformed. Because the way the passage tells it, it isn't after the meal he says this. It's in that moment of meeting Jesus and seeing who he was, he comes down out of that tree and says, "I'm a different man." He doesn't say it that way. He says, "Right now, Lord, half of my money's gone to the poor. I'm giving it all away, half of it. And the other half I'm reserving, not for my own convenience, but there's some things I've done wrong. And my commitment in the front of you and in front of these people is that I will make fourfold restitution, and at the most the law required at this point, full restitution plus 20%. I'm not into 120% restitution, Lord. I'm into 400% restitution. I'm saving that." And he came out of that tree, I think, after making that statement, a bankrupt man. Because half had gone to the poor and the other half, I mean, you can believe there was a long line of those people who would be quite willing to come. But all of a sudden, the treasure he'd given his life for didn't matter any longer. Because he'd seen Jesus. And Jesus chose to see through the eyes of love a man who others were quite willing to leave up a tree. And he says, "Salvation's come to this house today. This man's a son of Abraham." He'd always been a Jew. He'd always had Abraham's genes in his body, but now he has Abraham's faith in his heart. Now he's a real son of Abraham. He's a believer. And then Jesus turns to the crowds and he says, "This is what it's all about, folks. Son of Man has come to seek and to save lost people." And that's a message for you. If you suddenly come to recognize, you know, the way Jesus defines it, I'm a lost person. And Jesus came to seek and to find, to die, and to give his life, and then by his Spirit to confront you with the truth. That I came for someone like you, whether you're a Bartimaeus with a pressing need or with, like Zacchaeus, with an empty heart in the midst of so many things, came for you. And for the rest of us who've learned what it is to follow Christ, and as those disciples made their way up the hill into Jerusalem, they could never get over the story of that's what it's all about. This is what he came for. We don't understand yet about the cross, although they were going to understand it brutally in just a bit. But we serve a Christ who hears the cries of Bartimaeus and who doesn't turn a deaf ear when people call for help. And we serve a Christ who doesn't listen to the social statements about somebody, but who sees the heart of a person in need
and responds. And on the other side of this event, they were going to say, we've experienced the love of somebody who pays the price, no matter how great that price is.
Samuel Shoemaker, who was a pastor for many years and was influential in the start of what we know as the 12-step programs, once wrote a poem. I can only read it in part. I've read part of it before. I stand by the door. I neither go too far in or stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It is the door through which men walk when they find God. It's no use my going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside, and they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that many ever find is only the wall where a door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men with outstretched groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door, yet they never find it. So I stand by the door. Most tremendous thing in the world is for people to find that door, the door to God. The most important thing any person can do is to take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and put it on the latch that only clicks and opens to a person's own touch. People that die outside the door, as starving beggars die on cold nights in cruel cities in the dead of winter, die for want of what is within their grasp. They live on the other side of it, but because they've not found it and open it and walk in and find Him. So I stand by the door. The people too far in do not see how near these are to leaving. Preoccupied with the wonder of it all, some must watch for those who've entered the door but would like to run away. So for them too, I stand by the door. I admire the people who go way in, but I wish they would not forget how it was before they got in. Then they would be able to help the people who've not yet even found the door, the people who want to run away from God. You can go in too deeply and stay in too long and forget the people outside the door. As for me, I shall take my own accustomed place near enough to God to hear Him and know He is there, but not so far from people as not to hear them and remember where they are too. Where? Outside the door. Thousands of them, millions of them, but more important for me, one of them, two of them, ten of them, whose hands I'm intended to put on the latch. So I shall stand by the door and wait for those who seek it. I'd rather be a doorkeeper. So I stand by the door. And I believe God is calling Trinity Church to be a doorkeeper church in the Inland Empire. To enter the mission of Jesus. To seek and to save that which was lost. May we be faithful to care about the lost, hear their cry, see their need, and in the name of King Jesus, tell them about the price He paid so they could enter the door.